The boogeyman is real, and you found him.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
What's blood for, if not for shedding?
I'm your number one fan.
I like to dissect girls. Did you know I'm utterly insane?
We all go a little mad sometimes.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
7 days. I am Dracula.
We have such sights to show you, boy.
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains.
I am the eater of worlds and of children.
What's in the fucking box?
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
One by one, we will take you.
Never gonna happen again!
You gotta be fucking kidding.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
Welcome to prime time, bitch! Ha!
Welcome, welcome, horror fans. It is Wednesday, 7 p.m. Central Time, and it's time for another episode of the Week in Horror Podcast, the only podcast where all things serve the beam. And if you, dear horror fanatic, are listening to us at the top of the week, remember we do this live right here on YouTube every preceding Wednesday. So we hope to see you in the live chat. Come and join us. So this week, we are looking back at select horror films released March 10th through March 16th. Thank you all so much for joining me on what will surely be a bloody good time. I am JL, and I am holding down the fort. I am the last warrior in the base, and I am protecting the flag with everything I've got while my other guys are running around doing their thing outside. So I hope you all are having a fantastic evening. Let's see. First and foremost, let's get up that Patreon banner. There it is. Those are the names of all the amazing people who have to help us to make this show possible. We love you all so much. We appreciate it. We couldn't do this without you. So thank you very much. If you're interested in getting your name on the Patreon banner, supporting the show, what we do here, this live show, and of course, all the stuff we have going on in the background, check out our Patreon. Link's in the description. And you can support for as little as a dollar a month. We appreciate it. But thank you very, very much. All those cool names down there. They are cooler than you. So I hope everyone's doing great. We have some fantastic stuff to talk about. I don't know if Eugene will be joining me or if Alex or somebody else will be joining me. They have the link, but I know that they're busy. I know Alex has a long drive in between work and getting home, so no telling what's going on there. But if they pop in, they will pop in, and I will bring them up. If they are, I hope they get here before tonight's films because we have some interesting stuff to talk about, some fascinating little movies that I think are really, really cool. But first and foremost, we have a couple of other things to talk about. First, and I thought this was fantastic, just it's kind of an update for anybody out there who's a Mike Flanagan fan, okay? Because I am a diehard Mike Flanagan fan. That anything that man touches turns to gold, you know, it's gold. And ever since Absentia, I have fallen in love with his style. I have fallen in love with his narratives, with the world that he has slowly but surely built. I love everything that man has put out so far, and I think it's beyond cool that news came along that this is the guy who brought us, you know, did Stephen King adaptations of Gerald's Game and Dr. Sleep, and then of course movies like The Haunting of Bly, The Haunting of Bly Manor, Haunting of Hill House, The Midnight Club, Midnight Mass, and now he's Fall of the House of Usher. Oh. Chef's kiss. He's adapting the Dark Tower series. And I cannot wait to see what he brings to that. So that came down the pipe, and I was just so absolutely excited about that. It was absolutely freaking cool. So many cool things to talk about. That popped in. I was like, that's freaking amazing. But there's some other stuff that I want to get people's opinions on. But let's see who we have in the live chat tonight. Let's see who we've got. I see Raven Darkstar was first in there. 2.5 hours early, but good to see you, Raven. Hope you're doing well. Thanks so much for being here. Casey Cooper as well says, well met. Casey's manuscript is in the hands of a developmental editor. Totally psyched. Very, congratulations, Casey. Well done. You know, fingers crossed, going all the way. Who else we got? Travis Brown is here, says, evening, y'all. Finished watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre this past Monday to honor Gunnar Hansen, and wow, it is a great film. Amazing fucking movie. Absolutely amazing film. You know, that's why it's a classic. But yes, Gunnar Hansen was an unsung legend. Except for us. Us in the horror community, we loved him. and we praise him. So he's one of, like, you know, if there was a Mount Rushmore, he's definitely on it. I'm not going to argue positions because obviously Jason's in the first spot, you know, Freddy, you know, Gunner, you know, like Leatherface, Michael. So that's my Mount Rushmore. I don't know what order yours is, but that's my order. So who else we got here tonight? Who else we got here? Doctor Who Design is here. Good to see you, Doctor Who. Thanks so much for hanging out tonight. Left-Handed Jedi as well. Your prizes should be arriving shortly, hopefully. Teespring, let me know. So it should be arriving to you soon, you know, given that I hate their shipping shit. You know, it's interesting because I've been getting, like, these emails from another company that's trying to get me to they're pushing really hard to get me to get us to pull away from Teespring and go with them. And I've gotten like an email a day, you know, and it's weird because it's kind of passive aggressive because the dude who's sending these emails is kind of like, oh, you may be like the first one was like, hi, this is our pitch. And the second one was like, maybe the email fell through the cracks. This is our pitch. Maybe you're really, really busy. They're like this. And then they kept getting more passive aggressive as the emails came in. And I was like, I both am impressed and kind of like put off, but I found it to be funny. But hopefully those will be coming soon. Left-Handed Jedi. Let me see who else we got here. Sarcasm is here. It's a good evening, fellow horror rats. Good to see you, Sarcasm. Casey Cooper says, will the time change for some of the country affect start time here? So I was thinking about that. Where we are right now, where I am right now in Oklahoma. Oklahoma has decided not to observe daylight savings time anymore. So there will be no change for me. So as far as I know, I will be starting at 7. The show will go on at 7 p.m. That's it. So there's no time change for me. So it may change for others, which is weird. But Oklahoma has decided that they are not going to do the daylight savings time thing anymore. They are coming off of it. And so when we fell back last year, there will be no more spring forwards. So we gained an hour and then we kept it. So we are not giving up that hour anymore. I guess the governor was kind of like, nah, I want that hour. Tired of giving it away. So yeah, which is interesting because that means that no change in when, you know, no change in daylight out there. So I like the extended dark. I do. So even though the days will get longer during the summer, I like that it's not going to move like that. So automatically it's like, ah, you know, I like not having that shift. So that'll be nice. Cause it's just, you know, DST is just pointless at this point. It really is. Javier Hara, good to see you. Says Jello Jello, at least on time this time. Absolutely, you are. Thanks so much for hanging out. Angel Rivera as well. Says, what up, what up, horror fiends? Good to see you, Angel. Dib Dib, good to see you. John Monahan says, good evening, scary people. Good to see you, John. So many amazing members of the Army of the Dead. I see you. I see your names green in there. So fantastic. Good to see you all. Appreciate you hanging out. Rode, no last name. Gabba Gabba to you, sir. Says Gabba Gabba. Hey, everybody. Good to see you, Rode. Hope you're doing well. Fantastic. Let's see. Sarcasm, I have a well-read box set of the Dark Tower series. I believe Flanagan will do it justice. I absolutely do. I do. I am so looking forward to what Flanagan brings to that franchise. I don't think he can fail. I don't. Just out of sheer love for the source material, you know, the sheer love he has for the source material. I don't think he can drop the ball. I just don't think so. He won't let himself do that. Dib Dib says, is JL getting thinner? Oh, yes, I ran into an old gypsy man last year, and slowly but surely, it's been coming off because, you know, I accidentally insulted him, and he touched my cheek and said, thinner. And so, you know, here we are. I'm, you know, like this. And my wife is kind of like, you know, it's good, but it's bad because apparently my ass went away. And I just, apparently, it's what I've heard that from numerous people. It's like, where did your ass go? It's like, well, apparently it just went away. But yes, I am. I'm down, just shy of 100 pounds. So just shy of 100. So, and I'm looking forward to the next, you know, to the next milestones or to the next goal after that. So like I had set goals, you know, along the way, I've hit this goal or I'm about to hit this goal. I think I'm going to hit it at my next weigh-in. And then, the next goal after that is where my end goal is. So I hit this one. And then I got one more goal after this, and that's my target. That's where I want to be. So, you know, it feels good. You know, it feels better. It's kind of like that moment. You know, it's like you spend enough time because, you get yourself in that mindset where you really don't care. And you're like, there's really no need, you know, but then you just kind of like wake up one day and you're kind of like, you know, I want to do this, you know? And for me, I actually love running. I love it. I loved when I did competitive 5 and 10 Ks, I loved doing that, especially obstacle courses. I loved doing competitive 5K and 10K obstacle courses. I did. I loved them, you know, but it was kind of like the zombie survival run. I was kind of gearing up at a point. I wanted to try like Tough Mudder, but you know, it just kind of like fell through and you just kind of fall off. And then but I really enjoyed running. I really did. And I kind of decided I kind of want to get back there. So it's kind of like woke up one day. I was like, you know what? I want to get back to where I was. So I started. That was after my birthday last year. So I turned 43 and I was kind of like, you know what? Time to do it. And yep. So I just set my mind and I just like, this is what I got to do. And I did it. And here we go. Now my Mothman shirt looks like a tent on me because I haven't updated my wardrobe yet. So, but thank you very much, Dib Dib, for shouting that out. Appreciate that, but for noticing, appreciate that. Thank you very much. I know it's weird. There's like this weird corporate, there's like this weird mentality out there that asks, you know, obviously it used to be like, you can't comment that somebody's gained weight, but nowadays it seems it was a friend of mine, friend of the show. One of our big longtime supporters. On the back end, one of our producers, you know, pointed out to me in the kind of corporate environment, you can't point out that people have lost weight either because that person could be sick and that's the reason they lost weight. And so pointing out that they lost weight is just reminding them that they are sick. So because you don't know that, it's best not to comment ever on anybody's weight, which is just weird to me. So just odd how things change. So, but thank you, Dib Dib. Appreciate that. Helson, good to see you. Says, did your movie ever come out? There is news coming up on that, I promise you, like I've been promising everybody, as soon as I am able to talk about it, you will hear it here. You will hear it right here in the live stream first. As soon as we get word on, I can tell you what, I'll be able to tell you what film it is, when we're going into principal, and what's going on from there. Unfortunately, a lot of things are under wraps right now. I can't reveal too much, but the minute I can, the minute Eugene signs off, says, okay, now you can open your fat fucking mouth about it and just blabber on. You can guarantee I'll be doing it here on the show. I guarantee it. Very soon. I love it. I hate how things are so like boxed in. You know, things are so like, you know, insular at that point. You know, like at a certain point, it's like you got to keep them like, you know, under wraps. Until you get to sort of like that's how precarious this industry can be. So I hate it, but I also love it because that means we can do huge announcements, you know, later on, which would be a lot of fun. Aaron Reese is hanging out. The Army of Snarkness. Yes, yes. Good to see you, Aaron. Thanks so much for being here, bud. Appreciate it. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Dib Dib. Appreciate that. Let me see. Who else we got here tonight? Raven Darkstar says, hello. Oh, I see you went AFK and you came back. Good to see you. Dylan Prell, he says, I'm a new subscriber. Absolutely love the content, man. You've been binge watching the shit out of y'all's videos from Silent Horror to Modern Schlock. Awesome verity. Thank you very much. Yes, the whole, thank you so much. Thank you for subscribing. Appreciate it, Dylan. You rock. The whole big thing about Week in Horror was about the initial concept of Week in Horror was bringing professional filmmakers together so that we could kind of take a moment out of our professional lives to kind of remember why we're fans. When this becomes a job, when making movies becomes a job, it's very difficult to be a fan anymore. That's the hard part because you're so engrossed in making the things you love, you don't often get time to really sit down, decompress, and enjoy the things you love. And so to go back and, you know, like whether through the, you know, for nostalgia's sakes or whatever, to go back and watch the stuff or experience the things that inspired you to be where you're at or to go where, you know, to do what you do for a living. And so this was meant to be kind of like, you know, like bring filmmakers together for a little kind of like powwow about what we love about the genre, about, you know, about careers thing, you know, inspirations and shit like that, just to remember being fans. And so we decided to cover every horror film, all horror films around the world, going all the way back. We're talking like late 1800s, you know, to House of the Devil, you know, came in, you know, in, you know, that early experimental French silent films like this, all the way up to modern day. So we cover it all. So very, very eclectic show. We can cover Japanese, Italian, English, and Australian horror all in 1 week, you know, all over the place, just because those movies released that week in horror history. So we appreciate you, Dylan. Thank you so much for subscribing. You rock. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the content, but 5 seasons of stuff that you can get through. So over, I think it's all, by the time this season's over, it'll be like over 1,000 movies we've covered. So really excited. The future's, you know, sky's the limit. Let me see here. See, Raven Darks has apparently been here 17 hours. Impressive, Raven. Very impressive. Well done. Joshua Lee says, good evening, everyone. Good to see you, Joshua. Appreciate that. Aaron Reese says, the day JL has an eating disorder, I'll look like fucking Santa Claus. Wait, did somebody think I had an eating disorder? Oh, no. It literally, you know, it's dietary change and the gym. Now that my gym, see, it's a lot easier. I'll give you this. It's a lot easier to stay committed to exercise when the gym is in your house. And I completely sympathize with people who do not want or do not like having to like prep and go out and go to the gym like they're running errands. You know, like you know, because you got to pack up everything you need at home. You got all that shit prepped. You got to get in the car, drive down there, you know, do your thing. A whole bunch of people where you may not want to be in public like that at that stage. Then you got to drive all the way back home. Then you got to shower. And I understand for a lot of people who are very busy with their lives or people who have kids, it's a pain in the padded fucking ass. It really is. I get that. The first time I dropped down, the first time I ever got into competitive running when I was dropping weight, the first time I ever did it, I was able to do it because I was living in an apartment complex and I could like, it was like 50 yards to the gym. So I could throw on my workout clothes, do to the gym, work out for 2 hours, do, and then shower, I'm done. And it was easy. I could come home from work, go to the gym like that. And there was no downtime. And so, but when you move into a house, you know, like now that like the gym, the nearest gym to us is 30 minutes away. So I got to like get prepped, get a bag, get all my shit together. Then I got to get in the car, drive 30 minutes to go to a gym, spend an hour and a half to 2 hours in the gym, then a 30-minute drive back. And by that point, you're like, I have other shit I have to do. I need to be able to knock it out quick, which is why having my gym in my house, I can go and do it there. So like I get off the stream, go to the gym, come, you know, like clean up, come back here, get right back to editing on my next content. So I get that, you know, I got lucky because I was able to do that, to put that together. It took time, but I was able to put that together. And now here we are. So it just takes time, you know, and I totally get it. But everybody works at their own pace. They work at their own pace. So take your time. That's what you're building up to. Take your time. Lieutenant Jedi, thank you so much. So, so generous. Gifted 10 memberships to the Army of the Dead. Welcome all you brand new members. You rock. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Sarcasm says, I have lost 40 pounds over 2023, but I don't run thanks to a knee replacement. If you see me running, better beat me because you don't want no part of what's chasing me. Damn straight. That's straight. No, I am not remaking Debbie Does Dallas. Shh. Don't spoil it. Scotto, good to see you. Says, hi. Thanks all for the awesome gifted membership. You are very welcome. And thank you to Left-Handed Jedi. Appreciate that. Good to see you, Scotto. I love seeing new names in the live chat. Who else have we got tonight? Sir Little Wolf is here. Awoo to you. Good to see you, Sir Little Wolf. Hope you're doing well. Aaron says, if my timeline on The Office holds, I should be back the week after next. The water seals look to be working and the furniture is back in. I have to redo the curtains and lighting setup, though. Keep on it, bud. Cannot wait to see the outcome. Can't wait to see the new layout. I cannot wait. I do not hate Japanese horror. I do not, Joshua Lee. Don't spread lies about me. Don't you put that evil on me, Joshua Lee. Let me see. I lost 250 pounds. I got a divorce. Oof. Brutal. Thank you so much, Travis. Appreciate that. Really do. It's like JL speaks truth. Good throwback. Good callback, Sir Little Wolf. Good callback. Who else we got in the chat tonight? Who else do we have here? Sally Skellington is here. Says, hello. Hey, everyone. Good to see you, Sally. Thanks so much for the emojis. Hope you do enjoy the horror icon emojis that all you members have access to. So I do appreciate that. Let's see. Yes, moderation is key. And I think, and one of the big keys is learning when you're full instead of bored. And, you know, there are certain bad habits. There's bad habits, certain triggers. You get bored and then you know, you want to eat, then you kind of fill your boredom with food like this. And another really bad one that I had, that a bad habit that I had, was letting myself get overly tired and then eating to keep myself awake. So you snack in order to keep, because you have like, that's one of the toughest things about being, about doing content on YouTube, is that when you have to spend, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours editing in order to meet a deadline, then sometimes things will work out and you wind up in a crunch, and then you get tired. And then in order to stay awake, you snack. And that's the fastest way to throw on poundage, is by the consistent habit of snacking when you're tired in order to keep yourself awake so you can get your work done. That's really, really bad. So I managed to get that under control as well. So if I get tired, if I feel tired, sleepy, I go to bed. And I'll just deal with it, Leo, later on, you know, just like that. But yeah, just little key things like that. All right. Well, I see Eugene is not here yet, or he may not be here tonight. I don't know. He didn't message me, so I guess we'll find out. But I think I got everybody in the chat. If I missed anybody, I apologize. Good to see you. I hope you're doing well. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. And be sure to say hi in the chat. You know, I love seeing new faces, especially if there's any new people here. So let me see. Joshua Lee says, just remember, folks, when it comes to the zombie apocalypse, you don't have to be the fastest, just faster than the slowest. Absolutely. This is true. Aaron Reese says, dear God, keeping my kids from snacking because they're bored is like repelling a Mongol horde from within the pantry. Ah, yes. Ivy Gentry, good to see you. Sorry I'm late. Looks like we haven't started movies yet. We haven't. Just doing updates, you know, just doing kind of like updates to what's going on. But I do have two interesting things. The first and foremost was a news thing that came out, and I'm very curious. NANA, thank you so much, and good to see you. Thanks so much for hanging out. Who has just gifted 10 memberships to the Army of the Dead. Thank you so much, NANA. You rock. Appreciate that. And be sure, if you are not a member, if you don't have a YouTube membership, be sure that you activate the ability to receive, like you flip that tab to receive gifted memberships, because that's a tab you actually have to tab in your channel. So if you haven't gotten one and things are getting gifted out, you may not have that clicked. So be sure to go to your YouTube channel and make sure that, accept gifted memberships is turned on. That way you could be gifted one if somebody is generous enough to kick those out. Thank you, NANA. I appreciate that. You rock very, very much. All right. So this big thing that I found really fascinating, that I found really, really interesting, because, I like Blumhouse. I really love Blumhouse films. I really, really do. I think Blumhouse, while Blumhouse does like hit or miss stuff, you know, they're either, when they hit, they really hit. When they really miss, you know? And so it's always here or there. So, but I found this interesting because Jason Blum is apparently, according to Bloody Disgusting, is desperately trying to will a new Friday the 13th movie into existence. Paramount Plus is getting a Crystal Lake prequel series that will debut on there. Now, I don't know how Jason fits into that. It's like I said, it's a prequel series, so it'll be predominantly focused on Jason's father, Jason's mother, you know, events around that area. I don't know. But considering how Paramount handled Halo, I'm not, you know, my fingers are not crossed for that one. So I will watch it, but nah, you know, I don't know. So, but Blumhouse wants to. They want to do a Friday the 13th film, whether it's a reboot or a remake, or I don't know, or a continuation. I have no idea. But Jason Blum is apparently fighting like hell to try and make this thing happen. And I'm kind of curious. Blumhouse, given their track record, you know, given their track record of what's, you know, like the movies that have really slammed, the movies that have really not, I'm kind of curious. Was it Peacock? I thought it was Paramount, because is it Paramount or Peacock? You know, I almost said Peacock. Maybe it's Peacock. I don't know. Somebody check. Somebody double check me. It's either Peacock. It starts with a P. You know, it's P. So it's either Peacock or it's Paramount Plus. I'm not 100% sure. But if you know, I'd love to hear y'all's thoughts. Y'all's thoughts on Blumhouse tackling Friday the 13th. Can Blumhouse do for Friday the 13th what they did for like Halloween 2018? You know, they did Halloween 2018. Chef's kiss. Then they did like, you know, Kills and Ends, and they try, I mean, I get what they were trying to do, but they really didn't pull it off. They at least did it better than Zombie did with Halloween 2. But could they do it? Could Blumhouse? Yeah, I mean, obviously they can do, they have the money, they can do the thing, but can they do it? Can they bring back Friday the 13th? Can they do Jason? Oh, it's on Peacock. Okay, Peacock. Thank you, Angel Rivera. Thank you, Travis. So yeah, it's on Peacock. So yeah, Peacock will have a, I almost said Peacock too. Why did I second guess myself? Peacock will have a Crystal Lake prequel series coming out. So I have no idea what that, what's going to happen in that one. But let us know down in the comments below or at weekinhorror@gmail.com your thoughts on Blumhouse attempting to tackle Friday the 13th, bringing Jason back. Don't know. And Raven Darkstar says, doesn't matter. Peacock and Paramount will be merging anyway. Yeah. And Sir Little Wolf says, I don't like this. I see the don't. I don't like this. Yeah. And Paracord Princess, good to see you. Thanks so much for hanging out. She says, no, I'm seriously on the fence. I'm on the fence. Yeah. It's to the point that we just don't want it, that we shouldn't touch it anymore. You know, that we shouldn't. Just let it alone. Just leave it where it is in the past. All right. But I'd love to hear what you guys think. Let me know in those comments. Let me know in the comment section. Blumhouse tackling Friday the 13th. Yay, nay, and why? I'm very curious about that, given their track record. So, given their hit or miss track record. All right. Joshua Lee says, to quote Jurassic Park, they were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop thinking they should. It's true. They did. And Rhoda L. Sam said, it'll just be owned by Disney in the end. It will. It absolutely will. Sir Little Wolf says, it's too far gone from the 2009 attempt. Agreed. Agreed. You know, what are you going to do? All right. Well, we do have one thing I want to look at. I want to show you all. I don't know if you haven't seen this, this would be really, really cool. But there is a brand new trailer out for a film called Faceless After Dark. It has not released yet. The actual official release date, I think, is set. Where the heck is it? What is that official release date? This film is set to be released. It premiered back in 2023, but it has not hit streaming services yet. So I don't know when exactly it will be coming out. But it's called Faceless After Dark, and it stars Jenna Connell, who, if you remember her kicking ass in the first Terrifier film, she's a bit of a badass actress, stunt person, martial artist, fight choreographer. She's a badass. And Jenna is back in a movie called Faceless After Dark, and this is the trailer. So I hope you all enjoy it. Let's check this out. Cue up the terror tube. Oh, I love Jenna so much. She is so amazing. Just an absolute badass of an actress, and all the stuff behind the scenes she does. She is multi-talented, and I cannot wait to see her in this. Not to mention funny as hell. The girl's got fantastic timing. But that was the trailer for Faceless After Dark. So basically, following her breakout success in a killer clown horror movie, Bowie finds herself held hostage by an unhinged fan determined to recreate the film's final plot. So that is the plot of that, and it stars, of course, you saw her, Jenna Connell, Danny Kang, Danielle Lynn, Max Calder, Michael Aaron Milligan, Catherine Barnes, Jason McDonald, and Catherine Corcoran. So I'm very curious about this particular one. I'm really, really looking forward to it. So that is Faceless After Dark, and unfortunately, I do not have a date as to when that will be coming to streaming. So, because I'm pretty sure that the nearest 1 hour away theater here will not be picking that up. So, but I will be looking forward to seeing that when I get the opportunity. So, to let us know down in the comments below what you thought of that trailer for Faces After Dark. Kick ass, looks funny, looks like a lot of fun. Let us know down in the comments if you're looking forward to it or if not. You know, it looks like it's going to be kind of in the Terrifier vein, just not as extreme. So let's see. Yeah, Sir Kevin says, I do dig some meta horror. Hell yes, absolutely. Josh Lee says, the trailer's all over the place in my opinion, but I'm also curious. I am as well. Yeah, I love frenetic stuff, because even though frenetic trailers, people may not dig them, they don't give too much away. We get smatterings of stuff that will be there, but, you know, I like that nothing was spoiled, so that's a good thing. So I'm looking forward to where they're going to go with that. A lot of fun. All right, but that was the trailer for Faceless After Dark. All right. Well, the time has come, the walrus said, or the former walrus said, Yeah, that because we have horror movies to talk about. We really, really do. Horror movies to talk about. I want to make sure I didn't miss something. Did I miss something? I thought I missed something in the chat. No, I didn't miss anything. Okay, good. I thought I missed a new name popped in. Make sure I said hi to him. Well, if new one came in, I apologize, but good to see you. All right, but yes. Raven Doctor says, do not watch Gods of the Deep. Horrible Cthulhu. Oh, yeah, that was terrible. I did watch it. I already watched it. I watched it while I was in the gym. Because that's where I typically, once I watch the movies, once I rewatch the films in advance for the show, I watch movies when I'm in the gym. So I catch the next one. I saw Gods of the Deep. Terrible. Absolutely. Just terrible. Just not good. Not good. Had a couple of entertaining moments that made me laugh. Just kind of like, that was stupid. But yeah. But oh, yes. Yo, Joshua Lee. Joshua Lee asked me. That's what I missed. Joshua Lee asked me if I had. Yes. It says, oh, did you ever watch that movie, Lovely, Dark, and Deep? I did watch Lovely, Dark, and Deep. As a matter of fact, I watched it. And then we had a watch party in the Discord where we watched it there. And Lovely, Dark, and Deep is really fucking good. It really is. Now, the one thing to point out about this film, without giving away any spoilers, this is a technical thing. The film is beautifully shot. Absolutely gorgeous cinematography, okay? The acting is on point, you know? Georgina is just like, she's got the whole thing down. The kicker is that the plot itself takes a lot of notes from a lot of stuff you may have seen on the internet. And there's a lot of visual cues that have been utilized. If you are familiar with creepypastas, there's a lot of visual cues that are taken from creepypastas. This was definitely a movie, a horror film written by a person who grew up with the internet being a massive influence in their lives. You know, people who dig, you know, like, you know, slash, who are on Reddit all the time with like slash creepy or slash creepypasta, or spend time, you know, looking at those kind of channels. So on YouTube. So yeah, you say, oh, I know where they pulled that from. They work for the plot. It's not like they're just thrown in, you know, for effect. They work for the plot. So the director, Teresa, she weaves it beautifully. Teresa Sutherland, I believe is her name. She weaves it together beautifully, but you're going to recognize where these things come from. So definitely. I mean, in the first like 10 minutes, there's actually a visual clue in the film. And like in the first 10 minutes, you'd be like, that's where it stems from, you know? So yeah, but otherwise really good, really fantastically done movie, you know, really, really done. Yeah. I put those notifications out. So just keep an eye for those notifications. So all right, but yes, we have horror movies to talk about. So let's dive into our first one, shall we? I don't see Eugene or anybody here, so we're going to get right into it. Now, this is a fascinating little film because I know some people, because I know that there's a tug of war here as to whether this counts as horror. And after watching the film, and I watched it twice, actually, because it's fascinating. And I love the actors in it. It's just phenomenal shit. Yes, this is definitely a horror film. Definitely a horror film. So the first movie we're going to talk about tonight came out March 10th, 1978, and we have The Fury. So let's check out this trailer. Cue up the terror tube. It's like, fantastic. That was the trailer for The Fury, and I'm just, you know, kind of recognizing. It kind of just showed the whole film in that one. Like, the trailer just kind of, like, did the film. Dylan Prell says, thanks for all the good words, JL. My pleasure. It says, I hate how the spell check made me sound illiterate. Ha, but yeah, definitely my favorite channel now. I'm so tired of the same Freddy, Jason, Michael talk. Right. There's so much more to the genre. So much more to the genre than just the heavy hitters, you know? So many good things out there. Like this movie, you know? It's amazing. So that was the trailer for The Fury. So, and absolutely, I know there's some people who are going to argue that this film was a thriller film, because of some of the names that were involved in it. Obviously with, you know, like, you know, Kirk Douglas and, you know, Cary Snodgrass, and, you know, you wouldn't expect that to be that, but it is definitely a horror film, you know, just not as overt as De Palma's effort 2 years prior with Carrie. You know, Carrie, definitely, obviously, you know, extreme horror film. That was, you know, the way it was shot, you know, beautifully done. But of course, The Fury is a horror film. So directed by Brian De Palma, screenplay by John Ferris, based on John Ferris's novel, The Fury, which came out in 76. So this was adapted 2 years later. So the turnaround on this movie was fast, just like the turnaround on Carrie was fast, because I believe King published that in 74, 75, if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, that he probably did his first published work. And then like 2 years later, bam, we got Carrie the film. Same with John Ferris. You know, he published that book 2 years later, bam, we've got The Fury. And obviously, you know, Brian De Palma would have been tapped to direct this because it was a best-selling book. So it was Carrie. And then, of course, the adaptation, you know, it's along the same line. So this would have just been shooting fish in a barrel for De Palma. But, you know, to tell a brand new story. But there's some fascinating stuff here. So starring Kirk Douglas, legendary Kirk Douglas, first movie on the show we got to talk about with him in it. He didn't do a lot of horror films. John Cassavetes, who did a lot of horror films, Amy Irving, who has also done a bunch, Carrie Snodgrass, Charles Durning, Andrew Stevens. And I gotta point this out because this movie also had Dennis Franz in it. He was the cop driving the car when Kirk Douglas jumps in and carjacks them. He was the cop behind the wheel. So that's Dennis Franz, been playing a cop in New York for forever, you know? So Dennis Franz was in this bad boy. And if you watched it, of course, and Daryl Hannah. Daryl Hannah was in this as well. This was her first movie, her first film appearance. Appearance as she played Pam right there at the very beginning. That was Daryl Hannah. And then, of course, if you weren't looking for it. And I have kind of like, my wife points out, Angela's pointed out numerous times that I have this knack for recognizing faces from various stuff. Like if I see an actor on the screen, I'm like, oh, that's them from this one. That's them from this other stuff they've done. It's pattern recognition is all it is. You know, I happen to be pretty good at it. And the legendary Alice Nunn was in this. Alice Nunn played Mrs. Callahan, who was the housekeeper that you saw in a smattering of scenes, you know, the kindly, you know, lovable housekeeper. Alice Nunn was Large Marge in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. So Large Marge was in this movie. So you've got everything like fucking, it's so many good ones. You know, Charles Durning as well, Fiona Lewis, you know, Ratana Alda, William Finley. There's so many fantastic actors in this. And I just, you know, notice it. Oh, Kirk Douglas, John Cassavetes. Holy shit, that's Large Marge is in this. And fucking Daryl Hannah and Laura Innes. Laura Innes is in it as well. You know, so many got the, you know, Laura Innes, who was on, I believe, ER. For the longest time when that show was running. But Laura Innes was in this one as one of the students in the cafeteria sequence. So a phenomenal cast that brought this one together. And Amy Irving, if it can be said, just Amy Irving just fucking killing it. Just across the board. Amy Irving was phenomenal in this film. And of course, this was her opportunity to kind of run this kind of story after playing support to Sissy Spacek in Carrie, because Amy Irving was the good girl in that, who was like, you know, the bridge, you know, was like the bridge to Carrie in her humanity. And then in this one, now Amy Irving's the target. She gets to run with this and she fucking handles it. Not to mention her chemistry with virtually everybody on screen is phenomenal. Her and Kirk Douglas just rock together. So the film in itself, if you didn't get a chance to watch it, follows Kirk Douglas's character as his son has apparently psychic abilities, and they're supposed to go. They're scheduled to go there, and you know, Kirk Douglas's character, Peter, is like a former government agent. We are not told with who, like one of those agencies you've never heard of. His son is apparently a psychic, and he's supposed to go to a special school. He's betrayed by a guy he thought was his friend, and his son is kidnapped. And so he spends the movie trying to find his son, you know, trying to track him down while the bad guys are trying to kill him and trying to reunite with his son. But by the time he does, his son has, you know, his powers have gotten out of control and he has gone completely psychotic. And in the journey to find him, he has enlisted the help of Amy Irving, who is a newly identified psychic who can home in on where his son is. And of course, it's, you know, that aspect of it. And obviously, you will immediately identify that there are similarities between this and Firestarter, which I find really, really fascinating. So I had to look into that. You know, in and of itself, despite how good this film is from the narrative perspective, and the thing that kind of stood out to me, obviously, was that there are a lot of aspects of Firestarter that seemed to draft off of this one. Now, Firestarter itself was, if I remember correctly, I have to go to the 84. So that film, it came out in 1984. So The Fury came out in 78. Firestarter, the film, directed by Mark Lester, came out in 84. That film was adapted from the novel that came out from Stephen King in 81. So The Fury adapted from John Ferris's 76 novel. So in 1976, John Ferris wrote The Fury. And then in 1981, Stephen King wrote Firestarter. And it was quickly adapted just a couple of years after that, starring Drew Barrymore. The wonderful film, absolutely wonderful film. But I was looking at the two and kind of held the two up together. And there are some really odd parallels. And so it kind of stood out to me. It kind of like, you know, these things ramp so fast. The whole reason we got this really quick, we got this at this time, is at that time in the 70s, if you'll notice, like around that time from the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, one of the big major things that was going on, especially with, you know, within Firestarter, the utilizing, you know, like Lot 6, which was, you know, a hallucinogenic that was similar to LSD. You'll remember that at the time, the MK Ultra shit was coming out. So all the clandestine stuff that the CIA was doing when they were doing, this is the real life horror of it, when they were dosing civilians and contractors and people just to see what would happen and recording the effects, you know, because you have their mind control experiments. When that stuff started to become public, that was one of those big moments, you know, especially in the wake of the Vietnam War. That was one of those moments when the American people, the citizenry, began to realize that they could not, the dawning idea of that you cannot trust the government implicitly began to really dawn on the American people, and it began to really inform literature, film, all kinds of, you know, like all kinds of stuff. And, you know, talented authors began to jump on that, you know, and, you know, it became kind of the norm. There were other authors before that recognized these issues, that wrote about them extensively, but it became kind of hot in the late 60s, the 70s, and going into the 80s, when the kind of like anti-government trope, the idea that the government is not your friend, began to really inform stuff. And I noticed that there is a lot of, because it was popular, I have no doubt that, and yeah, Dean Koontz does it a lot of books about government conspiracies. Absolutely. We stopped trusting government after Vietnam. That's where it kind of kicked off. And then of course, you know, shit about, you know, and then you look at the things that came out in the 70s, you look at things that came out in the 80s, you know, you're like, you know, MK Ultra and Iran-Contra and all the other, you know, shit. It's kind of like, what are you going to do? And so obviously Ferris jumped on this story and he ran with it. It was, you know, and in his one, it was like the DSI, or no, in his book, he called it the PSI, which was Psy, you know, which is handling psychic kids. And then it was like slightly changed for Firestarter. Remember correctly in that one, they call it the shop, but in that one, it was DSI. So King called it DSI and Ferris called it the PSI, because Psy, you know, psychic, it was like psychic, psy, you know, whatever. And then King, it was the DSI. So there's a lot of parallels, not to mention the father on the road looking for, you know, the father on the road battling government agents, you know, that concept with the psychic, only instead of his daughter, but the father-daughter relationship, you know, with Charlie and her dad Andy. Charlie and her dad Andy. And then you've got Peter and Amy Irving's character, who was in this one. So Gillian. So there's so many parallels between the two that I found really, really fascinating. Now, obviously, King was telling a different kind of story, ultimately. Whereas in that, but they both kind of end the same way, you know, because in Firestarter, John Rainbird, you know, kills her dad, and then her dad gives her the last push to take out all the bad guys, you know, in this big epic fireball sequence that, you know, destroys everything. But in The Fury, is it kind of the same thing? As his son lies dying, he kind of pushes his ability onto her and allows her to stabilize her own ability. And then she uses that to kill the final bad guy, who is kind of like the John Rainbird in that story, in The Fury. Same kind of guy, the guy who's kind of like the guy who's got his hands in it, the guy who's running everything, the killer, the assassin. So, you know, I was curious. there's so many parallels. So both of them wonderful stories, you know. Honestly, I think that the movie Firestarter was better than the book because Drew Barrymore brought that energy. Not to mention her, George C. Scott was a magnificent bad guy as Rainbird. But the Fury was fun because the Fury felt grounded in a way that Firestarter didn't. And I liked the elements because it utilized elements of what was going on in the Middle East at the time. That the film kicks off there in Israel, you know, and it touches on ideas of like utilizing false flags and false flag attacks in order to accomplish other goals, you know, and who the government is willing to sacrifice in order to maintain its edge in geopolitical warfare. So I like that Ferris's was grounded. Okay. And De Palma brings it. De Palma brings it with his cinematography. He captures it wonderfully. I loved his, and again, you see, he kind of brings over from Carey his utilization of slow motion, of capturing things in slow motion in order to convey certain aspects, obviously, in order to allow the audience, given the extremity of the narrative, psychic warfare, all weird science fiction-y stuff. And then, of course, you know, people with, you know, bleeding out of their eyes and their hands, you know, like shit like that. To kind of like get over that, he utilizes a lot of slow motion in order to help the audience identify with the emotions that the characters are identifying with shit. So De Palma utilizes a lot of like, you know, scenes of people looking like Spielberg does. There's a lot of that, you know, they're looking that direction and the camera's on them and it's kind of slow and they internalize the horror of what's happened instead of focusing on the horror itself. So we get the emotion instead of that, which is where De Palma used the same techniques in Carrie, interspersed with giving us Carrie's experience with the frenetic out of control aspect, which, you know, reflects the idea of being a teenager in high school. You know, you're going every which way. So a brilliant adaptation that I think only De Palma really could have done and done it justice. It's a lot of fun, you know, and I just think that Ferris is a little bit more grounded in the things that were inspiring these writers at the time and these screenwriters and filmmakers at the time, that he used a bit more from real life, whereas King utilized his fake version of the CIA, which is called the Shop, instead of, you know, what's it called in real life? I can't remember what it's called. What they call it here with it, the Farm? No, that's the FBI. That's the FBI training facility. It's called the Farm. I can't remember what it's called, but I like that Ferris is a little bit stronger. The question that stands out to me is, given the time periods, and I've never thought I would address something written by King in this fashion, but the time frames seem to be a little too close together. So I kind of wanted to tap your guys's, you in the live chat. I kind of wanted to get your opinions on this. Given that John Ferris wrote his book, and this is the guy who wrote, I think, what was it? A ton of stuff. He was written so many things. You know, he was a prolific writer. I think still alive today. But John Ferris wrote this book in 1976. The De Palma adaptation came out in 78. And King wrote Carrie, I believe, in 74. And that came out in 70. And that came out, and that adaptation by De Palma came out in 76. And then Firestarter came out. So you had Carrie, De Palma adaptation, The Fury, De Palma adaptation, and then, like, so that's already kind of like King is aware, King is aware of that. So, and then it's like, so then quickly after that, almost 2 years, I think 3 years after that, Firestarter drops, and then Lester gets the adaptation for Firestarter 3 years after that. It was like a couple years after that, Firestarter came out, and then, so it was like 78, so 76 that came out, and then Firestarter, the novel, came out in 1980. So you had 76, so 4 years after John Ferris's novel, Firestarter dropped. And then Lester picked up the adaptation for that 3 years after that. So, but the Fury became popular because of De Palma's adaptation, because of the film. So the question is, given the parallels, given the narrative parallels, given the central figures, the father-daughter relationship, the on-the-road relationship, the trying to find, the search for something relationship, the overpowering assassin relationship, who's trying to be the good guy, but it's actually a bad guy, Ben Childress, to Childress connection. So many parallels. And the big epic scene at the end, like, you know, she burns everything down. She kills them all with fireballs in the end. In the end of The Fury, she blows him up. Like, literally, he explodes. Beautiful shot. They caught it with, like, 8 or 9 cameras. I think it was, like, 9 cameras in that shot. And caught the explosion from all those angles. They go, boom, 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 boom. The company. Thank you, the company, the Lieutenant Jedi. So, and Amy Irving made this work. She was brilliant. Amy Irving was on point. Thank you, Sarcasm. So, did King draft off The Fury? Did King draft Firestarter off The Fury? You know, did The Fury inspire Firestarter is my question. Is the reason we have Firestarter is because John Ferris dropped The Fury and Brian De Palma, who adapted King before, adapted this one and made it awesome. Did King then look at that and go, I can tell that story in a new way and maybe pick up another adaptation because it's popular at the time? Because, you know, that's a short turnaround. King is a pretty prolific writer. He'd be pretty nonstop. So FBI is the farm, CIA is the company, NSA is no such agency. I like that, definitely. What's Homeland? Yeah, tell me what Homeland is. So that's my curiosity. That's the question I have for the audience. Do you think King came up with, do you think King drafted off of The Fury? Do you think that's why we have it, you know? You know, did King draft off that? Or is it possible that coming up with the same ideas, creative, you know, kind of like the creative vacuum, sometimes you touch on the same thing at the same time. You know, he just happened to come up with it. Maybe he came up with it before and he just didn't write it till later. Possibly. But I'm curious, did John Ferris's novel, did De Palma's adaptation have any influence whatsoever on the appearance of Firestarter just a couple of years later? I'm very curious. So let me know down in the comments below your thoughts on the relationship between The Fury and Firestarter. Is the reason we have Firestarter because we got The Fury? If it is true, then The Fury holds a real place as one of those pivotal films that kind of helped to cement Stephen King in the cinematic zone, you know, giving him ideas like that and helped to establish him. He wouldn't be where he's at, or maybe not, who knows, if Firestarter hadn't come out and then established Drew Barrymore, you know, and then Cat's Eye, so on and so forth. So I'm very curious. There's connective tissue here, and I'm very excited to kind of explore it. Hey, me, good to see you. Thanks so much for hanging out tonight. Appreciate it. You rock. Sir Little says, Homeland. Humans only make enough land available now, dude, Homeland. That's hilarious. That's funny. Me says, I thought it was E.T. that established Barrymore. As kind of a scream queen when Barrymore started showing up in horror films, when she started doing horror movies. So, but yeah, E.T. obviously, you know, put on the map, her and Henry Thomas. So, but yeah, very, very curious about this. But definitely let it know down in the comments below. So very curious to hear your thoughts on that. Your thoughts on the connective tissue between The Fury and Firestarter. Is the reason we have it because of this movie. And if you haven't seen The Fury, definitely check that out. So good. Really, really good. And kind of drags a little bit in some sequences, but there's a lot of exposition. And you do not want to miss Amy Irving's performance because she fucking nails it. She nails it. God, Amy Irving was so fucking talented. She's so talented. You know, loved watching her in this. All right. Let's jump on to our next one. Released, this is also a fascinating one as well. So released March 11th, 1988, we have the film Pulse. So let's check out this trailer. Let's cue up the terror tube. All right, that was the trailer for Pulse. All right, so interesting little film, written and directed by Paul Golding and starring Cliff DeYoung, who is like, you know, the permanent 80s dad, Roxanne Hart, Joey and Matthew Lawrence. The Lawrence brothers were in this bad boy, and Charles Tyner, not to mention Robert Romanus, Myron Healy, Gene Sincere, and Tim Russ. Yes, Tuvok was in this bitch. He was one of the officers that arrived at the house. Tim Russ, one of his early films. So I love that, you know, you're seeing, you know, like, you know, the actors that we know and love today, you know, had their early starts, just like Large Marge in The Fury. So Pulse follows a family where the young son is currently staying with his father in jail polish. There's no polishing needs to be done on this one, Sarcasm. There is no polishing needs to be done on this one. there's some interesting stuff about this film. There really, really is. So the film follows a young boy as he is staying with his dad in Los Angeles when all of a sudden their house comes under attack by an aggressive paranormal intelligence that is thriving within the electrical grid system, moving from house to house. The film kind of kicks off with, the chaos happens in another house, ends up killing somebody, and then it goes to their house, attempts to do the exact same thing. And so it turns their quiet suburban neighborhood into absolute chaos as the Pulse tries to kill everyone that it comes into contact with by taking control of everything. And this is really interesting stuff. Now, the film in and of itself is, I thought, was this is a fun little kind of like 80s popcorn horror. And yes, Tim, we ain't found shit, Russ. Yes, thank you, Aaron Reese from Spaceballs. Yes, we ain't found shit. So a fun little 80s popcorn horror. You know, we get to see the Lawrence brothers back when they were young. He just kicks stuff off. You remember little Joey Lawrence? Matthew Lawrence. Matthew Lawrence was in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So, but this one is an absolute. I had a lot of fun watching this. The one thing that I thought kicked this off for me that I thought was really, really smart is how cheap the film was, yet how polished it looked. Okay, because one of the major things, if you think about it, if you go back and watch the movie, the vast majority of the film, okay, a lot of the so if you look at structurally speaking, this was a fascinating way to shoot a movie, and I thought this was really, really smart, was they took all the sequences that had actors in them. So you had a number of set pieces, but you really didn't have that many. You had some exterior shots, then you had some internal home shots, which you had three. So there were three internal home shots, and then there was the external shots of the street. But those sequences never leave a small area. So you've literally got this small little area to work with that you're running around in. And then you have your actors, your pieces with your actors, where they come and say their lines, do the deal, and then they move on to the next one. Very easily done. Not a lot of extreme stuff going on in the actor scenes. A lot of exposition, just a lot of dialogue, and some moments, okay? But that's fairly cheap. You're not running around the country. You're not doing all these massive whatevers. And the vast majority of the film, where the action is taking place, where the suspense or the tension or the horror is building up, are all the zoom-in shots of little things that are going on in your house at the time. So one thing I think is really, really cool, and I think should be acknowledged, was Cinema Research Corporation. So I was watching this movie, and for a movie that came out in 88, same year that Child's Play came out, same year that Friday the 13th Part 8 came out, you know? So a number of major horror films hit at that point. And this one came out in 88. 1 year later, Shocker would come out. You know, Wes Craven's Shocker would hit with Mitch Pileggi. You know, as a Horace Pinker, you know, one of the best fucking, you know, villains out there. I fucking love Mitch Pileggi as that one. I've loved it. I've loved Mitch Pileggi ever since I saw him in that film. So, but Cinema Research Corporation handled the special effects on this film. And I think it should be noted that CRC, okay, because not a lot of people may be familiar with who CRC was. Cinema Research Corporation was literally the industry leader in titles and in trailers, titles, and optical effects for decades in Hollywood. The film, the company itself was founded by Charles Patti in 1953, and he founded it in New York and then moved to California, you know, with the kind of the idea of getting into the film industry. And so by 1954, they had their first title, The Black Pirates, for which CRC did all the special effects. And then by the end of the decade, it was the largest special effects studio in Hollywood, California. I think it was an entire, I think the CRC compound took about a city block, was how big that was. And CRC ran pretty much, if you were a motion picture, you know, a major motion picture, and you needed opticals done, you needed special effects done, you needed post-production stuff done, you needed a trailer cut, you know, or, you know, titles, whatever, you went to CRC. They dominated. Why don't we hear about CRC anymore? Well, unfortunately, the company folded in 2000 after Charles Patti died. Charles Patti died in 2000, and the company folded after his death. It wasn't passed to anybody. And there have been a number of corporations after the fact that have kind of like taken up the mantle of CRC, but they're all defunct now. So kind of like, you know, trying to run off of that because CRC was an industry legend. The kicker, the killer, kind of like the nail in the coffin that kind of like cemented the decline of CRC into what we know today was Industrial Light and Magic, was ILM. And because ILM is West Hemisphere based, and technically, well, because ILM handles that, but then you also have, because they're both kind of Western Hemisphere, but you also have, would that be Western Hemisphere? I think so. Yeah, because there's America and there's like that, is WIDA Workshop. So you got WIDA out of New Zealand, and then you've got ILM out of California. So with the rise of ILM in the 80s, when ILM showed up on the block and started doing their stuff, they began to, because they were so good, they began to kind of divide and kind of like take stuff away from CRC. CRC was still a beloved industry standard, been around for forever, but ILM was just able to do things better and faster because they embraced brand new, riskier technology much quicker. So, you know, it's all about survival in that respect. So, unfortunately, oh, shut up, Aaron. So, unfortunately, we saw the decline of CRC, but I noticed that in Pulse. A lot of the little things that I thought were brilliantly done and not overdone, like all the lightning effects, all of the practical effects, you know, the electricity effects, like the sparks and the arcing and shit, all that was legit. There were moments when there were animated arcing that was taking place that was all handled by CRC, but all of those were done in a very diminished capacity. And I loved the utilization of the minimal animation as possible in order to give just enough effect to kind of like justify what's happening. And of course, showing, like, for example, the showing a circuit board where the circuit board is heating up to enough to melt the soldering and then readjust the soldering in order to create new pathways on the circuit board is fucking brilliant. Like showing shit like that, that's the shit that CRC did, you know, and all those moments, all those scenes kicking up where they would take normal stuff that was running around your house, like taking a wiring setup and running electricity through it to the point where you're amping up the voltage and then running enough volts in it that you actually melt, you know, cause a meltdown in the system, cause the wires to burn out and shit. All that stuff was handled by CRC and brilliant, brilliant work. I loved the attention to detail in this that made it feel more real. Unlike a film like Shocker, where it's as much magic as it is, you know, electricity and shit, you know, Horace Pinker jumping into the television, coming out of TVs and shit. That's all, that's kind of the goofiness of that, but which makes that movie fun. This one utilized so much. And if you're in maintenance, if you've ever worked in maintenance, you will watch this shit and you'll be like, you'll be able to pinpoint what they're looking at and little things that people do, like the whole screw falling into the fan and then getting, you know, black and get caught in the head. I've had that happen. You know, shit fall into blades, shit fall into fans, then being kicked off back at me and damn near miss, you know, and near misses. I've had that happen, you know, and then show you, you know, all these little, I love the attention to detail in this one and how grounded it was. You know, they never really identify what this entity is, just that it's holed up in the transformer, you know, like in the transformer outside. So it's holed up there attacking the house. They managed to cut it off. And then the big sequence where they knock down where the father cuts down the thing. As far as it goes, it's an entertaining film that I enjoyed more than most of the, you know, technology run awry. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. It's up there. I put this one up there with like Killbots. I refuse to call that movie Chopping Mall, even though I know a lot of people love Chopping Mall, you know, but like Shopping Mall, yeah, but it's Killbots. Other than magic lightning, because in the 80s, there was a spate of movies where lightning was magic and could do magical things if you had enough lightning, Killbots being one of them. And this particular one obviously gave rise to movies like Virus, you know, that we got later on in the early 2000s with Jamie Lee Curtis and a number of other ones. But I dug this one as kind of like one of the last films to come around and play with the, you know, lightning is magic trope before it became the internet. And then the internet became magic. So I kind of dug this one, Maximum Overdrive, you know, weird. So, you know, like, whether it be like, you know, natural phenomena that are suddenly not, that suddenly become supernatural or an aspect of them. I dug this one. It's kind of like, it's just a fun little popcorn film with some decent acting, some decent set pieces, and some really, really solid effects from a classic American icon, which was CRC, and they did really, really intriguing. They did really, really fascinating shit. A lot of good movies that they worked on, which were a lot of fun. So I like that they did, and they didn't go overboard. The use of practical effects in this one is what drives this movie. So you don't get too extreme, like animation effects or like weird shit that, the practical effects are what, we're always going to be about practical effects is what sells this movie. The attention to detail as well. Seeing these things close up, that micro photography, so you can see all the little details, I think is really, really neat, which makes it a lot of fun. Not to mention, decent acting. You get to see, it was funny because I got to see Charles Tyner in this one. Charles Tyner was in Evil Speak that we talked about a few weeks ago, where he was the head of the military school, and he's the guy who actually does like the spanking when he spanks. He does corporal punishment on Clint Howard's character, where he's like blah, blah, like that whole sequence. That was Charles Tyner. Charles Tyner, like kind of like the resident like creepy old guy, because he was also in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. He was in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. He was in Evil Speak. He was in The Longest Yard, Emperor of the North Pole. Like a bunch of Harold and Maude's where he got to start. So, but yeah, a lot of fun stuff. Not to mention Cliff DeYoung. And it's funny because Cliff DeYoung actually beat out, if I remember correctly, there were two other actors who auditioned for this, and they decided to go with Cliff DeYoung. And if I remember correctly, David Morse and Tommy Lee Jones both auditioned for that role. Oh, you can tell JL's mind was blown his mind when he saw FX. Dude, FX is an amazing fucking movie. FX and FX2. Brilliant shit. Fucking, Brian Krause. Come on, man. Brian Krause and, you know who I'm talking about. The cop. Son of a bitch. Remind me his name, Aaron. I remember Brian Krause because, he's the Australian guy. But, son of a bitch. No, it's Brian Krause? No. What the fuck? I'm fucking up all over the place. Hang on a sec. Brian something. FX came out 86. Brian Brown and Brian Dennehy. Yes, Brian Brown, Brian Dennehy, and it had Jerry Orbach in it as well. So, yeah. And Cliff DeYoung. Cliff DeYoung was in that too. He was. Brian Dennehy. Oh, man, I haven't thought about him in a minute. That's right. Yeah. So, but yeah, Tommy Lee Jones and David Morse both auditioned for this film. Cliff DeYoung beat them out. And I found that interesting because David Morse would have been fascinating in this role. At that age, same with Tommy Lee Jones, it definitely would have changed the structure of it. I think the tone of the film. I think Cliff DeYoung was the right choice. Cliff DeYoung was good. That was a good one on that one. It's interesting that the film itself, Paul Golding, got the idea from two unrelated events. The idea for Pulse, when one night he was at home and he was in bed and he couldn't sleep and he was listening to the house, and it was the noise of the natural noises of the house, and he got this overwhelming sensation that the house was alive and that it was like kind of taking care of him. And then he'd heard a story about a computer that was able to reprogram itself, and so those two ideas are kind of what helped Pulse come into being. So how that comes down to it, you have the interesting things you hear, how they're going to get translated into film in order to tell these stories. So but yeah, Pulse was an entertaining movie at minimum, and a nice little callback to a Hollywood icon, CRC, and recognizing what they brought to the industry before pretty much, it fell into ILM's hands and Weta's hands. So Weta Workshop and Industrial Light and Magic when they really took over. So, but CRC was really nice. It was nice to watch a movie to get a kind of an example of the stuff that they used to do and their kind of brilliance bringing in. And I love that CRC always had a real strong focus on practical effects because that's what they came up in. Whereas ILM, big on, computer-generated imagery. Whereas CRC really focused on bringing really top-notch practical effects to films. So that's who brought those into those films that you loved in those trailers that were really good in the 80s and the 70s and the 60s. CRC were the minds behind that, which I thought was really, really cool. It's nice to get to talk about them and, what they brought to the industry and how they made the movies that we love so much, how they made them so awesome. But yeah, definitely check this bad boy out if you get the opportunity. So, all right, let me see. We got, now we're talking about FX, because Brian Brown, who's been in a number of things, and legendary Brian Dennehy, who's since passed. He passed a while ago. But yeah, Extra J, I see you. Thanks so much for being here, bud. Appreciate you hanging out tonight. Thank you so much. Make sure I didn't miss anybody else. I thought I saw a new name there. Maybe it was Extra J. Let me see. Nope. Think we're good. Aaron Reese says, Mitch Pileggi is an understated badass. Seeing his chainsaw at the X-Files. Oh, his arc in the X-Files is brilliant. You know? And I loved him in Supernatural, too. But he's done so much stuff. I love Mitch Pileggi. He's fantastic. The Skinner-centered episodes of X-Files were some of the best. You know? Especially the one with Amanda Tapping, where she played the prostitute and he wakes up the next morning and she's dead. You know, her head's twisted around, and then you know he's seeing the image of the old woman who's been like protecting him since Vietnam. You know, oh freaking, you know, the Skinner centered episodes were always so good. All right, so let's check out our next one. What do we have up next, JL? I'll tell you what we've got, JL. Released March 14th, 2003. We have the remake. Might be a black mark against this one. The remake of Willard. Let's check out this trailer. Cue up the terror tube. All right. That was the trailer for the remake of Willard. So, 2003 when that came out. Written and directed by Glenn Morgan. Based on Ratman's Notebooks by Stephen Gilbert. And Willard by Gilbert Ralston. Starring the legendary Crispin Glover. And yes, for that, left-handed Jedi, Crispin Glover was Mr. World in American Gods. And yes, he was in Friday the 13th, Part 4. He was corkscrew cleaver to the face guy. So, and Crispin Glover, Laura Elena Herring, Jackie Burroughs, and the legendary R. Lee Ermey. You know, love that dude. Not to mention Bruce Davison, Ty Olson, Kimberly Patton, and Jackie Burroughs. And yes, Bruce Davison did portray Willard in the original 1971 film. He makes a cameo appearance as Willard's late father. So he was, you know, the image is there. He played the portrait above the fireplace is of Bruce Davison, you know, portraying Alfred Benjamin. Bruce Davison playing Alfred Benjamin, Willard's dad. So, yes, they did kill the cat. Yeah, they did. You know, actually, that's one of my favorite sequences. He puts the cat in there. And then the cat sees all the rats. The cat just pisses itself. I just thought that was fucking hilarious. There are a lot of really, really fantastic moments in this one. And of course, brought to life by Crispin Glover's performance. It is, in essence, is the exact same story. They focus a little, it obviously, in I would say, much, much darker in tone. In 1971, the idea of this, the original is available for free on YouTube if you want to check out the one with Bruce Davison playing Willard. There's a weird new energy to this new Willard. Obviously, you know, 1971 was the original, 2003, so over, was that 30 years since the original one. So a lot of time has passed, new technology, new cameras, new cinematography, and of course, CG effects, because the original Willard, all rats, all the rats were real. Every single, you know, every rat in that. This one, there are some moments where they use computer-generated rats, but they also use a lot of rats as well. There's a lot of rats in this particular one. I especially love Socrates. He's so cute. But there is definitely a different energy on this one. What we really enjoyed, because we talked about the original Willard, I believe it was last season, and what Bruce Davison brought to that role was, I think the whole, I think he captured the source material very, very well. The idea in that is of mental, is essentially centered around mental health and how people need to have control and how having power in one's own life is paramount. And so Bruce Davison's character, the big difference is never really comes off as a victim, as being victimized by other people. So he is, and to a degree, slightly less sympathetic than Crispin Glover's Willard. Okay? And because Crispin Glover does have such a phenomenally expressive face, he can convey these deeper and more nuanced emotions, I think, better than Bruce Davison can. Bruce Davison can emote a strength, an internal strength that Crispin Glover cannot. That I think they're just two, you know, fundamentally different actors at their core. So Bruce Davison is able to bring about this idea of what people will do to regain control in their lives, you know, when they get the short end of the stick and they just feel kind of like the universe is kind of like, you know, they just are just unlucky. That's the idea, is like Bruce Davison's character felt unlucky in that respect. And he was kind of like, his unluckiness or his lack of success drove him. And when he discovered that he had this bond with these rats, drove him to this point where he began to retake the power in his life. Crispin Glover's Willard does the same thing, but Crispin Glover's Willard is, I would say, phenomenally more victimized than Bruce Davidson's was. So because Crispin Glover's character is more sympathetic in that respect, where Arlie Ermey is going out of his way to victimize this. His mother passive-aggressively victimized him. Everybody victimizes him at some point, whether it's his coworker who emasculates him, whether it's his mother who infantilizes him, whether it's his boss who just degrades him, for whatever. It's just like the weakness of the natural lack of imposing nature that Crispin Glover embodies lends itself to being victimized by other people, Like his nerdy, kind of skinny, lanky look, like George McFly. His whole reason, George McFly in Back to the Future, that's, George McFly got victimized because what's he going to do? Until he finally stands up and punches Biff in the face, with that epic sequence. So, but yeah, Crispin Glover's whole physicality, his whole demeanor lends itself to darkening to bringing a darkness, a darker energy to the film, which I think fundamentally alters the scope of the movie. Because when your lead is that victimized, then the comeuppance must be increased in order to justify that level of degradation, that the level of victimization that your protagonist, or who quickly becomes your antagonist, is undergoing. You don't see that extreme differentiation in the first one. Davison brings it kind of here, and then the outcome is about the same. It's maybe a little bit higher, but it never exceeds it because the story never takes it above and beyond what would be necessarily acceptable or what would be societally acceptable. The revenge is equal to the slight. In this one, the revenge is equal to the slight. He is so slighted, so his revenge is so justified until eventually the power is taken away from him once Socrates dies and Big Ben exerts his influence, and then becomes a war of wills between, who really is in charge. Is Willard just being victimized by the rats again, being utilized, and he has this connection, and the rats under the authority of Big Ben are just utilizing him for food. It's like, it's easy access, so we can just use him. He's just another tool to be used. Whereas Socrates embodied the bond between the two of them, the white and the black. So whereas the rats begin to victimize him again, then becomes a war of wills between Big Ben and Willard as they try to really fight between another, and then it ends the way that it ends. So if you haven't seen it, if you've seen it, you know how it ends, or you can suspect, but I don't want to spoil that for anybody who hasn't seen it. But the acting in it is what really brings it. Crispin Glover demonstrates how altering such fundamental aspects of the lead can fundamentally change the film to something completely different. So this is a remake through and through. It's the same story, but told in a completely different way, which I found really, really fascinating. A lot more nods to comedy, because remember, it's a darker story. So you've got a guy who's really victimized, a revenge that's really, really extreme. Arlie Ermey being eaten to death by rats, and then this sequence coming up, not to mention the darker tones of the house. The house is not as well lit. It's dark. It's creepy. His mother is, his mother is disgusting. And at the same time that she's bedridden and spewing everywhere, she's infantilizing him to his face, And he's her provider. He's her caretaker. She would have nothing. She would lie in that bed and die if it wasn't for him, and still to his face, and him just taking it and taking it until eventually it comes out, and he discovers that he has one point in animal magnetism and he can control animals or whatever. If he played Vampire the Masquerade, the one time animal affinity or something like that, if he has one point in that, he can actually influence animals. So, but yeah, I would say that in the wake of 2003, the decade that Eugene loves so much, when digital film was making its it was really in the foreground. So at that time, telling stories like this were very akin, had a lot of, yeah, I would say a lot of connectivity to the, those scripts were influenced by a lot of things that were going on at the time. So other things that were influencing writers at the time were things like D&D, things like White Wolf, and a number of other sources that were bringing edgier, darker storytelling to people's lives. And it was cheaper to do it because of digital technology. So I could see in like you could see influences of this, of what was going on, how in the late 90s, 2000s, there was more of a sense of, I think, overall, a kind of malaise and a kind of like willingness to embrace the darkness underneath everything we saw, to embrace that we don't need to tell super happy stories or tell stories that are that have like this kind of like artificial balance between the victim and the revenge, the victim and the comeuppance, and the victim or the protagonist, the antagonist, where they're kind of balanced like that. That we can tell stories that are far, far darker. We can reimagine older material to kind of reflect the new light. It's very, very similar to what was done with The Blob in 1958 and The Blob in 1988. Fundamentally, foundationally the same story, but the nuance, the details of it are radically different. From, you know, Steve McQueen's run as the all-American boy and the all-American, you know, the all-American Midwestern town and Americans uniting to come together to defeat the evil alien, and, you know, together we can accomplish anything, you know, to 1988, 30 years later, it's the bad boy, the outcast, the guy who, the rebel without a clue is the one that we have to fall on because the government and general Americana are completely inept and ignorant because they can't get out of their own way and they want to live in the past. So those individuals who are willing to buck the system and think outside the box and be, you know, and be creative, to think spatially instead of linearly, you know, and not to and don't trust implicitly, that post-Vietnam era mentality altered the scope of that story. With this one, with the 90s, it was the exact same thing. This is still that downhill momentum. Post-70s, post-Vietnam, post-MKUltra, post-Iran-Contra, post that what we thought was good or what represented good had fundamentally changed. So we got remakes of these interesting stories from decades ago in darker fashion that were able to speak. And I think the reason that they work is because they speak to people on a more primal level or a more intimate level. People were able to identify with Willard better in the 2003 one than they could with Bruce Davidson's one. Because in the 70s at that time, he was milquetoast. People wouldn't have passed, you know, you pass him on the street, you wouldn't notice him. That's just a sad state of affairs. And this one, we identify because we feel what Willard is feeling. It's no longer a hypothetical bad guy. It's a dude that you identify with because you've been through it. The willingness to take the legitimate personal experience and put that on the screen to really internalize the experience of humanity and utilize that for storytelling without sugarcoating it, that's where horror excels. And that's why Willard, the 2003 remake, that's why it works. Because it understood, because the filmmakers at that time in the late 90s, from the 90s to the 2000s, filmmakers began to understand that we do not have to have this whole like post-Hays Code idea of bad guys wear black hats, good guys wear white hats, bad guys have, you know, they twirl their mustaches and you know, and the white guy's always on his white horse. This Lone Ranger bullshit didn't have to persist anymore. Audiences as a whole were not that dumb, and they were recognizing that these stories, they just couldn't. It's like Superman. American icon, yes. But can you identify with Superman more than you can identify with Batman? That's the point. All in all, Superman is an ideal, you know, but he's an alien. He is that which humans cannot be. Batman is a person. Crazy, but so people identify with Batman more than they identify with Superman or Wonder Woman for that matter. Well, technically more women identify with Wonder Woman than guys identify with Superman. More guys identify with Batman because those concepts we can be aware of. This, the true blue idealism, idealistic America, freedom, democracy, that's so far gone that people just don't touch on Superman, which is why we get these darker versions of Superman nowadays. but Batman is always there. The same with this. When filmmakers were able to take it upon their shoulders to tell stories that audiences could legitimately identify with, why Scream was so good in 1996, why that kicked off the meta-horror genre, is because it identified what the audience was thinking and put that on the screen so it could tell them, you are validated. And we get validated by watching these films because we feel like they recognize us, because they do, because the writers and the directors do recognize that, because they're willing to put more of themselves on the screen. And I thought that's what makes, that's one of the big reasons why this film, I think, kind of surpasses the original. Bruce Davison was good. Don't get me wrong. Willard is a fun movie. But this one was willing to take it in the direction that the story needed to go, that the 70s, that filmmaking in the 70s just wasn't ready for. You know, this was the opportunity to use new technology to tell a story in the way that it should have been told, that focused very, very heavily on mental illness, on the struggle for control, the struggle for identity, and how much we rely on others to tell us who we are. You know, how pervasive that is, and how if we get that one rung of control, we can actually be deceived by that. People can throw us a bone and the bone can actually be a trap, and we don't recognize it until we're trapped. And then we fight against that as well. And now it's a never-ending cycle. I love that they brought that energy to it, you know? Plus with a phenomenal cast. Crispin Glover, I think, was the perfect choice for this. I don't think anybody else could have brought Willard to life other than him. Crispin Glover was phenomenal. I love him, whatever he does. Creepy Smoking Man was fantastic. He was great in that one in Charlie's Angels. But I love Crispin Glover for what he brought. And I love Arlie Ermey for what he brought to this one. God, he's such a fucking ranged actor. Son of a bitch, Arlie Ermey was good. The whole thing was just, I think, this is an example of a remake that captured the essence and did it fucking better. You know, so if you haven't had a chance to see the original Willard to contrast it against, definitely check that out. It's free on YouTube. And of course, Willard is on Amazon if you have that one. So definitely check those two out. Put them against one another. 30 years, just like The Blob, 58 to 88. This one, 71 to 2003. So you'll get a really, really fat, the struggle for agency. Yes, Ronan said the struggle for agency. So definitely check those out. I think these are two fantastic examples, just like The Blob original and The Blob Steve McQueen and The Blob remake in 88. So I was trying to remember her name. It was Shawnee Smith. So definitely give this one a watch. I really thoroughly, plus there's a lot of moments that are kind of laugh out loud. I loved it. You know, just like the cat pisses itself, just cracks me every time. See this movie like 10 times. Every time I see that cat piss itself, I just fucking crack up laughing. It's absolutely hilarious. You know, and then the cat falls to the rats, and it's sad. You know, that didn't need to happen, but hey, fucking rats, man, rats. Plus, it always gets me. It hits me when Socrates dies. It gets me every time. It just breaks my heart. He's so little, and he's just a little white mouse, and he's so friendly. And then the dickhead that kills him, he's punch him in the face. I'm glad he got eaten. Fuck that asshole. So. Me says I laugh at horror movies more than I should. I sometimes do too. I sometimes do too. Definitely. The dancing in Friday the 13th part 4 top. Oh, he was legendary. All limbs, man. Just all, it was like, just all limbs and shit. I fucking love it. You know, God, he was great. Just, like where those limbs are going. Where are those limbs going? Crispin, do you even control them? Do they have minds of their own? Travis Brown says same with the dog and evil speak. Oh, just killed me. That's why when they did that to the dog, and actually, in actuality, it was the evil presence that pushed them to do it in order to manipulate Clint Howard's character even more so. That's what's fucked up, is that the dog was important, and in order to further push him to the degree that the power could use him, it manipulated the bad guy, manipulated the students to murder the dog, so that he would lash out and be prepared, be willing to, the power could take over him and exact his revenge. It's fucked up. You know, that's such a fucked up movie. But God, so good. Evil Speak was so fucking good. So goddamn good. All right. We got one more to talk about tonight. It looks like I am right on track. I'm right on schedule. I started handling it. Good movies to talk about tonight. Really, really good ones. Really fantastic shit. So the last movie we have to talk about tonight. And I really wish like Johnny had been, because Johnny would have fucking loved this movie. He would have loved this fucking movie, because he loves anthologies all day long. Oh, Casey Cooper says you do a good rant. Thank you, Casey. I appreciate that. gotten quite good at it, you know, this whole YouTube thing, doing the whole, like, you know, and horror movies all fucking day. This next movie we're going to talk about tonight, the last one for tonight, released March 16th, 1973, going way back in time. And we have The Vault of Horror. So let's check out this trailer. Cue up the terror tube. All right, that was the trailer for The Vault of Horror. And not a spoof. So, but I can understand why you might think that it is. So, The Vault of Horror, also known as Vault of Horror, Further Tales from the Crypt, and Tales from the Crypt Part 2. 1973 British anthology horror film directed by Roy Ward Baker and written by Milton Subotsky, based on Tales from the Crypt and shock suspense stories from EC Comics, written by Al Feldstein and Bill Gaines. And of course, starring a bunch of legendary actors in this. You've got Daniel Massey, you've got Terry Thomas, you've got Kurt Juergens, Michael Craig, Tom Baker, yes, Doctor Who, Tom Baker, Anna Massey, Glynis Johns, and Don Adams, not to mention a number of others that are classic, you know, English actors that have been popped around there, that have popped throughout television over on the BBC. But this one is a lot of fun. The film itself is a collection of short stories, a collection of stories where five men come together one night and meet in what looks like a gallery. And while they're there, they realize that they have to be there. And then each one of them seems to be plagued by a recurring nightmare. So each one, they go round the table as they're enjoying their drinks and doing the British show, ha ha, bully, doing their thing, basically sharing their stories of their recurring nightmares. And then each story provides an entry in the film. And then eventually it's discovered that the men are always doing that because they have no choice, because of the dark deeds in their lives. That is what they are meant to be doing. So really, really, this is a lot of fun. Yeah, same chords opening of The Shining. Absolutely. Dun, 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 dun. I love that shit. So, like 5 minutes. Yes, Omni. Omni Orosimus, just like the five men in a circle coming together. Yes, very, very fun. Yep. I gotcha. Anyway. The film in itself is a lot of fun. Okay, so five interesting little stories came in there. You've got Midnight Mess, you've got The Neat Job, This Trick Will Kill You, Bargain and Death, Drawn and Quartered, and of course you had the framing narrative, the intro and the out, the intro and the finale on there. And of course, Midnight Mess follows a dude who runs into a group of vampires. You've got The Neat Job, where a guy who is obsessively neat drives his wife to commit murder. Then you've got This Trick Will Kill You, which is about a magician who tries to steal a trick while vacationing in India, who tries to steal a magic trick from a local Sufi and winds up paying the ultimate price. And then, of course, Bargain and Death, where an insurance scam in an attempt to bury a guy burying himself alive, utilizing a drug that will make him appear dead, you know, winds up getting more than he bargained for. And then, of course, Drawn and Quartered, which was the best in it, because it stars Tom Baker as an impoverished artist living in Haiti, who finds out that a local critic and a gallery owner have been lying to him about, you know, the popularity of his work and have been making money off of his shit. And he's poor and they're making money off of his works because they'll pay him a pittance and then they'll sell him because he had no idea how popular his stuff was. And he winds up in kind of a Dorian Gray situation where whatever he paints affects reality, and then he can damage the paintings to exact his revenge. That's a lot. That's a fun one right there. I really enjoyed Drawn and Quartered. So one of the things, what can be said about this movie is that it's what came before this film. At the time, in the 70s, in the 60s and the 70s, there was EC Comics. So it's important to note that EC Comics at the time was pretty much known for, at the time they kind of established themselves in the, I think it was the early 50s, is when they came out with, EC Comics had their line through the 50s and the 60s, where they specialized in tales of terror, well, basically horror stories. And they had different lines. They had shock suspense stories. They had Tales from the Crypt. They had the Vault of Horror, and I think there was a fourth one, if I remember correctly. There was a fourth one. They also did like true crime. They did like crime suspense stories. But all of these comic book tales in this comic lines for all of these were typically smaller adaptations of the stuff that people are already aware of. So they took stuff like the Telltale Heart, a lot of Poe, a lot of Lovecraft, a lot of Shelley. They took Shelley's work. They took Wine's work, Murray's work, and they would adapt these stories to fit the time, to fit the 50s, and tell them in a short form. The Haunt of Fear. Thank you, Aaron Reese. The Haunt of Fear. I knew there were four. The Haunt of Fear, Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, and Shock Suspense Stories. So those comics were out that were out and about. It was those comic lines that gave rise to the original Tales from the Crypt film, okay, which came a few years before this one. Then you got Tales from the Crypt Part 2, Tales from the Crypt Part 2, which was actually The Vault of Horror, which is interesting because The Vault of Horror, this film that we're talking about today, did not adapt any of the stories from The Vault of Horror. All those stories were adapted from Shock Suspense Stories and from Tales from the Crypt. And if you'll notice, a couple of these were reutilized in the 90s adaptation with The Crypt Keeper. The one voiced by John Cassier. A lot of these, like for example, the one where the woman who's keeping the house tidy and she pisses him off and kills him, and then winds up taking out all his organs and shit and putting him up on the shelf and everything. That one was adapted and altered a little bit, but the same kind of like ending sequence where the wife ends up killing the husband and then preserving him. You know, in the taxidermy one where the woman is, you know, obsessed with animals, has animals all over the place, and the husband gets pissed, ends up taxidermying all the animals, and in revenge, she murders him and taxidermies his ass. So there, you can see a lot of these made their way all the way to the 90s. So these were repeats. What's fascinating is that EC Comics, you know, established these as kind of like the guy who played Marcus Brody in Indiana Jones. That's right. He was in the last one. So you had Tom Baker and you had Denholm Elliott. Denholm Elliott was in that as well. So Marcus Brody from Indiana Jones and Doctor Who. Marcus Brody and Doctor Who were in the last one, which just made it fantastic. So what I found fascinating was that in the history of this, hey, Lori Marie, good to see you. Thanks so much for being here. Appreciate you hanging out. In the history of this, EC Comics' horror lines eventually led to what we know as the Comics Code. So very, very similar to what happened with film and how you had the Hays Code, and then the Hays Code kind of fell off. You had the Hays Code kind of come up like that, censorship. The same thing happened with comic books. The reason that the Comics Code got introduced was because, just like, because there was a motherfucker who basically was the Jack Thomas of his time. Like, if you remember, you know, Senator Jack Thomas, who was the guy who was like the Florida senator who was raging, a Florida congressman who was raging against video games. You know, video games were affecting the youth. There was a similar dude. I cannot recall his name. There was a similar dude who did the same shit for comic books back in those days, and he pitched a fit about how comic books were degrading the youth of America, turning them into slackers and shit like that, and, you know, basically, you know, like, just terrible. So the Comic Books Code was introduced. So EC's stories, those stories themselves in EC Comic Books lines, those things pretty much ended after the comic book code, after the Comic Code was installed. Because the censors got along, came in and shut those down. Fortunately, EC had managed to get those stories into film when film was a bit more of a, where you had more leeway at the time, and get those things running post the end of the Hays Code. And then, of course, Hammer Horror really established the ground on that. Individuals like Alfred Hitchcock really ran with that. And then bam. And then so the comic book stories, the stories that were there, were able to be kind of salvaged because they were able to segue into film very easily with horror anthologies, especially these were coming out of Britain, which was really, really nice. And so they were able to segue them there and keep them alive for translation in the 90s when we finally got Tales from the Crypt over on HBO. But then again, those stories also inspired. You'll see inspirations in The Twilight Zone, in Outer Limits, in Tales from the Dark Side. So those little tiny little stories that EC Comics developed, which gave way to Creepshow, the Creepshow comic, okay, which came, you know, those little, so EC Comics establish an entire range of shit that we grew up with. Those little short anthology, those little short little kind of like little short movies that we came up with on HBO. You know, watching John Cassier as the Crypt Keeper, and then of course series like Tales from the Dark Side, The Outer Limits, and Twilight Zone, and Ray Bradbury Theater and shit like that. Those little stories that they did in those comics of EC Comics line adapting the stuff, the legendary stories that we grew up with, and taking them and adapting them for the new era, set a trend that essentially informed us for those who grew up as Gen X, in the Gen X period from 79 and 79 on, which I thought was fucking cool. Those roots run deep, and that these stories here, you can see them. You know, if you want to check them out in Vault of Horror, if you want to check them out in the original Tales from the Crypt film, which I thought was really, which also is really, really good as well. But yeah, the history behind this one was really, really fascinating. Now, as far as the film goes, it's extremely well shot, very, very quick. They get to the action fast because they got to tell these five stories really quick. If there were four stories, it might have been a little bit more. I think five was perfect because we get into the action and we establish these things without way too much exposition. We establish these things quick. And of course, the build up to the Tom Baker one, where Tom Baker's the bad guy, the build up to that one is phenomenal. Plus, you can see Tom Baker with a big ass, like, you know, Bob Ross beard, which I thought was just so different. Plus, that guy can go dark, which I really like that. I like seeing him in something other than Doctor Who. Not to mention Denholm Elliott as a bad guy, the bumbling Marcus Brody as like the evil art dealer. You know, it's just fantastic. So. I really, really enjoyed this one. Vault of Horror is a lot of fun. You can check out Tales from the Crypt, the first one. And then, of course, Vault of Horror as well is kind of a sequel because those are the same stories adapted over. And then you can get a sense of the stories that were passed along that really informed our childhoods through Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Dark Side, you know, and Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits, Ray Bradbury Theater, and so many other dark ones I thought was really, really cool. These, you know, EC Comics is where the grounding of that all was, where we get these stories, you know? And I know as I was talking to them, JL took his Bob Ross beard a little too far. I kind of did, you know? I'm going for Wizard. I'm just going for Wizard. So definitely check this one out. I believe it is on Tubi, if I remember correctly. I think it's on Tubi. But definitely check out Vault of Horror. It is a lot of fun. You're going to enjoy it. And despite the fact that it's a British anthology horror, it is not as dry as it was, almost like it was shot for American audiences. So if you enjoy Hammer horror, you will fucking love this movie. So definitely check this one out. Really, really dug this one. All right. So the question that I have for the audience, and I realized that I actually missed a couple of questions. So I have a couple of minutes. So let's go. Let's backtrack. So, wow, I'm doing all the questions at the end. So, the question that I had for Pulse. What has been your creepiest home occurrence? You know, home alone, lying in bed, it's dark. Something creepy, you know, like, did you hear? Did you happen to see? What has been your, given that Pulse was kind of inspired by a creepy home occurrence, I'm kind of curious, what was your creepy home occurrence? What have you found has been creepy in your house? You know, how has your house kind of creeped you out? Let us know down in the comments. And of course, for Willard, that was an easy one. Which one did you prefer, the original or the remake? Did you prefer the original or the remake of Willard? You know, let me know. I'd love to hear in the comments which one you liked best, Willard or the original Willard with Bruce Davidson, or the remake with Crispin Glover. And for Vault of Horror, that question's pretty simple as well. Which one, which entry was your favorite, or do you think was the best? Which entry do you think was the best in Vault of Horror? Personally, it's Drawn and Quartered. That was my favorite. I love the way it ended. Skylight, paint thinner, blah, blah, melt you. Like, I fucking love that shit. So, but definitely let us know. Those are the CTAs. I totally forgot to give them at the end. I was on kind of a roll. So, but that, there you go. But definitely let us know down in the comments below, weekinhorror@gmail.com. Would love to hear your thoughts. I saw a couple new names in, or a couple of fresh names. Elizabeth S., good to see you. Thanks so much for being here tonight, as well as Castellar Daniel Garcia. Good to see you. Pulse is creepy. Thanks so much for hanging out tonight. I think I got everybody. I don't think I missed anybody. See Omni Oros Boros, you know, giving me a double entendres. I did see that NANA gifted another 5 memberships to the Army of the Dead. Thank you so much, NANA. We do appreciate that. Very generous of you. Thank you so, so much. All right, Baker for the win. Hell yes, Left Hand Jack. He was great in that. All right, but That is our last one for the night. And you know what time. That means it's that time. You know what time it is. Raven Darkstar knows what time it is. It's trivia time. That's right. It is trivia time here at the Week in Horror Podcast. Hey, Robert Bider, good to see you. This is Bugger, once again, no notification. We'll have to catch up on the recording. Definitely, sir. Definitely. Raven Darkstar says, nope. All right. So tonight's trivia question is, and if you get this one right, I've got the live chat pulled up. Got it going right here. First person with the correct answer in the live chat will win a special item from the Week in Horror store. We have so many cool things there. I actually added two new items, two new mugs, a Michael Myers No Lives Matters mug is available. And if you like camping, there is a camping mug. There is a Friday the 3rd, I would say a Jason-inspired camping mug available on the store as well. Those are also possible prizes that you could win tonight. So two new items on the Week in Horror store. Not to mention we have the puzzles of all of our limited edition artwork, but two new mugs. So we have the Michael Myers No Lives Matter mug, and we have the Jason-themed camping mug, you know, like the thick metal camping mug. So those are on the store now. But be the first person in the live chat to get the correct answer to this trivia question, and you could get a special item from the Week in Horror store. Here is your trivia question. Get those Google fingers ready. What legendary British actor originated the role of the Crypt Keeper? What legendary British actor originated the role of the Crypt Keeper? Let us know. Be the first one in the live chat to get this correct answer, and you will get yourself a prize from the Week in Horror store. What legendary British actor originated the role of the Crypt Keeper? Who's got it? Who's got it? First correct answer in the live chat wins a prize. Who's got it? It wasn't Spock. Nope. Ravendar says Christopher Lee. Wasn't Christopher Lee. Travis Brown nailed it with Ralph Richardson. Yes. At the time, Ralph Richardson was one of the go-to British actors next to Laurence Olivier. You know, Laurence Olivier, you know that name. But at the time, Ralph Richardson was up there as well. And Ralph Richardson is who originated the role of the Crypt Keeper for Tales from the Crypt. So, Ralph Richardson, congratulations, Travis Brown. Let me make sure I get your name down. Bam, bam, bam. Travis Brown kicking off March with a big win. Well done. Had some other deals there. Donald Pleasance. John Cassier did the one in the 90s for HBO. But yes, congratulations, Travis. That was legendary actor Ralph Richardson. Well done. Travis Brown says, just want to get more questions right. Want to get more questions right than sarcasm. Ah, very nice. Aaron Reed says, Queen Elizabeth. Oh, never mind. She just outlived the Crypt Keeper. Ah, that's funny. Very cool. Yes. Yeah, John Cassier originated the role of the... that was for HBO. That was the job. I can't do the Crypt Keeper laugh. But yeah, that was John Cassier doing that voice work. But yes, Ralph Richardson, legendary actor there. You know, huge filmography. And that, my fellow horror fiends, will conclude this episode of the Week in Horror Podcast. Thank you all so much for joining us tonight. We truly hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, smash that like and subscribe button. Be sure to hit that bell so you never miss a future episode. Join us next week when we look back at the stylistic mind bender, The Devil's Candy, the savagery of nature in Backcountry, Stephen King's alien horror Dreamcatcher. Yeah, we got shit weasels on the way. And the serial killer horror Fender Bender. Be sure to check out Josh Olson's store at badsamurai.store. He does all the awesome artwork you see splattered all over our merchandise. And for more from Week in Horror, check out all the bloody links that are down in the description. Follow us on those socials for your daily splatter. Join our Discord for watch parties, big announcements, all kinds of horror shenanigans. Hang out with us, the crew. And of course, support the show through channel memberships with the Army of the Dead, Super Chats, PayPal, or even through our Patreon for as little as a dollar a month. We don't get to do the cool stuff that we do without that support. You guys make that happen. So thank you. Little as a dollar a month. What are you waiting for? Join us! As always, thank you to each and every single one of you amazing horror fiends out there for being the greatest audience that a horror film podcast could possibly have. I am JL. We'll see you all next week. And as always, you know how to say it. Stay scared.